From 90.1 WFYI Public Radio, welcome to The Art of the Matter, made possible by the ongoing support of listeners like you and from the Palladium at the Center for the Performing Arts, presenting its inaugural season through June.
Hello and welcome to The Art of the Matter. I'm Travis DiNicola. The music for today's show is courtesy of the Baselli Walrab Jazz Orchestra from their Heart and Soul album, available through Owl Studios at owlstudios.com.
And I'm Sharon Gamble. Today I'll find out more about a quilt exhibit at the Indiana State Museum.
I'll host a roundtable discussion about ethics and business practices for professional visual artists.
And I'll find out about the grand opening for the new home of Indiana Landmarks. And of course, there's our arts calendar we call
What'll We Do? All that and more right after the latest news from NPR. So, you think quilts were invented strictly out of necessity, don't you? As Sharon Gamble recently discovered, quilting traditions run the gamut from elegant to instructional, and you can see the whole spectrum in frugal and fancy Indiana quilts on view at the Indiana State Museum through July 17th. The ISM's Mary Jane Teeters Eichhocker, curator of social history, and Kathy Moore, communications director, brought some quilts in with them for this conversation.
So, in this exhibition, two different schools of quilting? Would schools be the right way to describe them, Mary Jane?
Styles, perhaps,
styles?
Sharon.
They kind of came together, and which one was frugal and which one was fancy, and where did they come from?
Well, of course, American immigrants brought their culture with them from Germany, from Europe, excuse me. And the fancy style was an upper-class style that you did if you were wealthy and could afford the elaborate fabrics or the elaborate workmanship. And that mostly was a British Isles production in which they would use either whole cloth, in which the pattern was entirely done in the stitches, and these were often silk quilts or glazed wool, often done by professional male quilters. Or they would use an applique design based on buying a couple of yards of very, very expensive imported Indian floral chintz. And this was a point at which European printers could not reproduce all the colors and designs and things that could be done by Indian, East Indian craftspeople. That fabric was imported. They would buy a couple of yards, and then to make it fit a whole bed, you would cut out the motifs and rearrange them, applique them on a plain background, and it was a style called, it was a chintz applique style. There is an example of that in the exhibit. It's just the centerpiece of a quilt that was never finished, but it shows that very elaborate style that was really practiced only by people wealthy enough to spend a lot of money on a couple of yards of imported goods.
And even those people are pretty inventive about stretching that very expensive fabric.
They really were. I mean, if you were really wealthy, I guess you could have bought the yardage and made everything out of the yardage. But boy, that was putting on not one dog but two or three.
How does quilting relate to embroidery or needlepoint? Are they related at all?
Well, the same people did most of those things if they were upper class. Needlework was intended and thought of as something that upper class women should fill their time with, since our brains were too weak to indulge in mathematics and languages and business and so forth.
Wait, I have to pause you right there, because anybody who's ever quilted knows how much math is involved and how much engineering. Let's see, creativity, of course, but wow, what a misconception. Yeah.
But education and the view of women was very, very different in the 19th and 18th centuries than it is today.
I have this perception, and it might be completely false, and it's probably from some costume drama movie I saw somewhere, that the wealthier and more privileged you were, the tinier your quilting stitches would be, the finer your hand and your motor coordination mm-hmm. would be, that was a sign of breeding somehow? Is there any validity to that?
Well, only peripherally. You often were sent to needlework schools that taught you those fine hand skills. Those were not free, and so you had to have enough money to educate your daughters. It was another indication of the amount of time you could spend doing that. If you were ordinary person, your impetus was more to make warm covers for your family, and you might be in a hurry, especially if you had 12 children to get bed covers for.
Sure.
So that's where that more frugal style comes in. Came largely from the Scots-Irish, who had this piecework tradition or strip quilt tradition.
And was that about recycling fabric and not wasting it? Was it what the popular conception is, which is my 6-year-old has outgrown her dress mm-hmm. and there's no younger daughter to pass it on to, but I like this fabric, so I'm going to put it in a quilt?
Sometimes that was true, particularly later after the 1830s or so, after the Industrial Revolution made all that manufactured fabric cheap enough to have access to.
Hmm.
And then you were using that fabric, the printed and the striped and the patterned fabrics. Then you had that available. And you didn't waste that stuff. And you might, anybody who sews knows that there are offcuts. So you might, rather than making your quilt out of half-worn fabrics, unless it was a real utility piece, you would use those offcuts and be brand new fabric. It would simply be that you were using those little leftover parts, and you'd already paid for them by when you bought the fabric for the clothing. But the earliest quilts, people have the idea that American quilting started out as this very frugal craft. And if you were an early pioneer, the first thing you did was weave blankets. And it wasn't until that weaving tradition had really gone by the board because of the Industrial Revolution and the ability to purchase fabrics that you had that kind of scrap tradition quilt appearing. We do have in the museum an extremely rare hand-woven two-piece, it amounts to a blanket that's been quilted. And it and several others like it came from southwestern Indiana in a tradition that may have come up from the upland south. I'm not quite sure what the borders of that tradition are, but it's certainly a style that would be much earlier than the pieced quilt and speaks to that weaving tradition. And then when nobody had the huge looms in their houses anymore and were not weaving that fabric, then a piecework, an applique tradition, could supplant that.
Hmm.
That quilt actually looks kind of like denim. From a distance, you think it's denim. And then and it's two colors. Is it black or navy? I forget. And red.
It's a dark red and a dark blue. And when you look at it, you think, because it's in a quilt
exhibit. It's very heavy. It really does look like denim mm-hmm. until you get close, and then you realize it's wool and linen or something like that
mm-hmm.
woven, and it's...
And it has only one seam. It looks as though it's pieced, but it's simply horizontal stripes, and it has a center seam. Yeah. And so it is, in essence, a blanket.
And very warm.
Mm.
Very warm.
Back to the fancy quilts for a mm-hmm. moment. These quilts that these upper-class ladies of all ages were making, were they actually used, or were they decorative?
They were used. Who knows how many were originally made?
Mm-hmm.
Not that many survive
mm-hmm.
because they were used. They were also, you're very right, for show. And if it was only to keep warm, you could have used, almost anything. But in the early period of quilting, beds were found in the best parlors. It was simply you had a different way of organizing your house. And your best room might contain your best bed and your other best furnishings, and that's where you entertained. So you wanted something that was really nice to show off, and you would use it. But you also, it was also a way to attain status.
Weren't they also for special occasions, too, though? So they might have shown it because it was a wedding gift or
later
something
on,
like that?
Later on, like in the mid-19th century, you had those beautiful red and green applique quilts, of which we have two gorgeous examples in the exhibit. And they might be put on the bed only for a special occasion.
Hmm.
Yeah, we're kind of conflating several time periods.
Lot of labor to just bring something out once or twice a year, if you think about that. Wow. It's like using your grandmother's china only once a year.
That's what, to me, is so interesting about the show, because I'm someone who does some crafts. I'm not all that. I'm a little too ADD to sit down and do it forever like that. But to, you know, I think that even if you have no crafting at all in your background, you can look at those quilts and just have such, you're just in awe of the work that goes behind those. And, you know, the months that they must have spent, some of them by candlelight, doing all this hand stitching, it's just, it's unbelievable how much work went into it and how perfect it can be. You know, a quilt that has tiny little half-inch squares that, you know, if you cut it an eighth of an inch off, it's not going to work.
Right.
That's the math that you said before.
Right.
You know, they have to be perfect in their cutting. They also have to be perfect in their stitching so that it'll come out right. So I think that people, even if you're not interested in quilting, you still would have an appreciation for seeing these things in this show.
How many are in the museum's collection, and then how many of those are in this exhibition?
There are over 700 quilts in the museum's collection.
Wow.
And it's a collection we're actively building because it's a very important part of Indiana's tradition. There are 33 quilts in the show. There are 24 full-sized, four wall quilts, and then a crib quilt and four doll quilts.
And
so they're all sizes.
You've brought a couple of the doll quilts, and I'd like you to describe them. Let's start chronologically with the older of the two.
The first one I have here is a navy blue and white single Irish chain, and it's the blocks are miniaturized, so it looks like a miniature of a full-sized quilt. The navy blue blocks are printed with these tiny little white stars, and it's quilted every half inch or so all the way across the piece, and bound in fabric that's exactly the same. It's probably from the 1870s.
And it's about 2 feet by a little more than 24 by 30-ish?
I'd say about 24, 26 by 14 or so.
Mm-hmm. And would a doll quilt be a natural project for a daughter to have her mother teach her how to quilt? That would be her first project, maybe?
That's often what it was. This one looks like it was either a more expert sewer, or the mother,
mm-hmm.
possibly an older sister doing it for the child. But that's frequently how a child was taught to sew, because, of course, then she had, and I say she because it usually was a girl.
Sure.
Although boys were taught to quilt, especially if they were sick in bed a lot, or if they were, there are a lot of wonderful quilts by Civil War veterans who made them as they were recuperating.
Hmm.
So it wasn't always a women's craft.
Speaking of the Civil War, the sewing machine came into wide distribution about when?
Late 1850s, 1860s. They finally got many of the kinks worked out. It was one of those things that took about 50 years to finally get it to work right.
Hmm.
And then when Isaac Singer got into the picture shortly after the Civil War, he really developed the marketing that allowed everybody to have a sewing machine by payment plan or one of the many other, or joining a sewing club, and, you know, 10 women got together and bought one machine and shared it around.
Hmm.
So pretty much after the Civil War, you start seeing the machine used for either the piecing or even the quilting, because, of course, at that point, it was a status symbol to have the machine, and you wanted that machine stitching to show.
This the newer of the two doll quilts you've brought, though, is still hand-stitched, right?
It's still hand-stitched. It's a very small 1920s quilt. It's an album, the album cross pattern in a blue print and white. And right across the center has been embroidered in a darker blue, the name Patty. And we know the family this one came from. It was a German family, the Schocks, on the south side of Indianapolis. made either by the mother or by one of the three daughters, and we think Patty was the name of one of their dolls.
Aw. And lest people think that quilting hasn't become quite modern, there's a really cool quilt in the exhibit that you essentially, I don't know if commissioned is the right word, but requested from a friend. And I want you to tell us about the QR code quilt. This cracks me up that you would even think to do this.
This is so cool. QR codes are appearing on a lot of products now, and you can, if your smartphone has, if you download the QR code app, you can click on those different codes and sometimes get recipes, sometimes see more information about the product. We thought this would be a great way to give a little more information to the visitor. So I asked Sherry McConnell of Anderson, Indiana, to make us a QR code quilt. It's black and white, squares and rectangles. It's hanging in the exhibit. And if you focus on that quilt, you will be led to a video that we have made showing how the exhibit Frugal and Fancy was put together as it's hanging within the exhibit.
And it was a little nervous making for Sherry as she was making it because these codes are really precise. That's why they're normally printed on paper.
Right. This is only the second QR code in fabric we've ever heard of. And she was quite concerned that it was actually going to work. And then we were quite concerned because there was a little, an extra step in the posting of the video that we didn't know about. So at first it worked and then it didn't. So everybody started chewing fingernails for a little bit. But it worked magnificently. And it was machine quilted to help it stay flat and so that it would read better by Deb Geyer, who's also in Anderson. And, of course, we asked them to do that right around Christmas time.
Nobody had they didn't have anything else.
Anything no stress
else
or anything.
They didn't have 10 other Christmas projects they were trying to sew.
Of course not.
Sharon Gamble with the Indiana State Museum's Mary Jane Teeters-Eihocker, Curator of Social History, and Kathy Moore, Communications Director. You can see quilts, including the QR code quilt, in the exhibit Frugal and Fancy Indiana Quilts through July 17th at the Indiana State Museum. Learn more at indianamuseum.org.
You're listening to The Art of the Matter on WFYI 90.1 FM Public Radio. The Indianapolis Downtown Artists and Dealers Association, or IDADA, believes that understanding and practicing fair business standards is in the best interests of artists individually and their profession as a whole. To that end, their Ethics and Fair Practices Committee has established a set of guidelines to help artists recognize standards of common ways of doing business and for the arts community to be aware of accepted recommendations for dealing with artists. Travis DiNicola invited three members of the committee, Dan Cooper, Mark Rushman, and Shannon Linker, in for a roundtable discussion about these guidelines.
I am Shannon Linker, and I am the Director of Artist Services and Gallery 924 at the Arts Council of Indianapolis.
Dan, you're next.
Dan Cooper, visual artist, painter, chairman of IDADA's Ethics and Fair Practices Committee and instructor at the Indianapolis Arts Center.
Excellent. And Mark?
Mark Rushman, Rushman Fine Art, dealing privately here in the city in the arts business for the past 25 years.
Very good. Well, thank you all for joining us today on Art of the Matter. This is going to be a little bit different format than our usual sort of straightforward interview process. Shannon, you first approached me about this as far as sort of having a roundtable discussion, if you will, of members of IDADA talking about the ethics and fair practices policies that I believe you've recently put in place and have been a model for artists to use. I guess my first question is, what sort of ethical and fair practice issues are artists running into that you would even need a document like this?
Well, you would be surprised how many times these things come up. And a lot of artists don't necessarily recognize them as ethical issues. They just think they're business decisions that they're not maybe very business savvy, so they don't really know how to handle. But it's things that come up with artists all the time. And pricing your artwork and making donations to nonprofits and placing your artwork in non-traditional spaces, such alternative spaces, maybe a government building or a nonprofit location or a corporation, that sounds like a great opportunity, but maybe it's not the best situation for the artist. There's lots of different things that come up for an artist that if they're not aware of the best practices and the way to protect themselves with contracts and guidelines and all of these things, it can be a bad situation for both parties. And so what we're trying to do with this is come up with a set of guidelines that are a good rule of thumb for not only artists, but arts organizations and corporations and individuals looking to hire and work with artists, so that everybody's protected and everybody gets their fair share and it works out for everyone.
So they are guidelines for people who are either buying or requesting art, as well as the artists themselves. And to be clear, I mean, and you did explain it very well, but these are business practices, not these are not ethics or fair standards of anything to do necessarily with the content. Is that correct?
Exactly, yes.
Okay.
How to do business is what it's all about.
How to do business. Dan, my guess is that all of you have run into situations where perhaps you could have used or saw someone that could have used these fair practices and ethical guides.
Exactly. One of the common words that artists hear all the time is, how would you like to have this opportunity?
That word opportunity comes
right.
up quite a lot.
It shows up everywhere. And a couple of years ago, I had already become an active member of IDOTA, Indianapolis mm-hmm. Downtown Artists Dealers Association. And after getting several opportunities arrive in the email, one in particular kind of bugged me about the opportunity to place my art in a new office space.
Where lots of people could see it.
Yeah,
right.
Lots of people could see it, but we really don't want to buy it. We just mm-hmm. want to show it on our walls and conference rooms and stuff. So Shannon and I started emailing back and forth and found out that we were totally in agreement and that it would be, but there's no way, there was no resource for helping establish what's right or wrong in cases like that. So at an IDOTA board meeting when Jason Zickler was still president, I asked about, should that be something that IDOTA covers as ethics? And he said, fine. Name your committee. So, of course, Shannon was the first one on it. Then Mark Rushman here has joined us, and a few others, Ellie Siskind, Cindy Wingo mm-hmm. at the time. Carla Knopp is now a member of our committee. And so after getting together, we came up with several issues that we thought that we could take a look at right away and came up with our guidelines that, like Shannon mentioned, several of them. And these can all be found now on the IDOTA.org website. There is an ethics and fair practices link, and topics include compensation, gallery and artist relationships, donating artwork, commissions, juried shows, art fairs, copyright, and we also reprint the Declaration of Artist Rights, which was came up with several years ago.
Mark, let me ask you, going back to something that Dan said, I'm sure that you've dealt with this, have had many opportunities to deal with this, and working with professional artists who you've shown at your gallery and who you've worked at, a lot of people do think, whether it be businesses or individuals, that, you know, just giving an artist an opportunity to get their work out there is such a great benefit to them that they're actually kind of surprised that artists may not always want to donate everything they do. I mean, there's sort of an assumption, well, it's just their time, or it's, you know, otherwise where would they be showing their work? I mean, but this is actually a pretty significant issue.
Yes, it is. And as Dan said, artists are frequently presented with this opportunity, and in all fairness, a lot of people think that it's a very good thing to offer space to an artist. But if you think about it in terms of an artist running a business, mm-hmm. and once an artist decides they're going to sell their work, in essence, they're becoming a small business. And if they don't have the inventory to sell, if it's just on loan somewhere, or if it's tied up for an extended period of time, then you're actually taking opportunities away from an artist to sell their work. So there's really a lot of different things that come into play when an artist is deciding to show or exhibit their work. And just the offer of free space isn't always the best decision for their career.
Well, I think you raise an interesting point, too, because, as you said, being a professional artist is like running a small business, and there are many costs. There's the overhead, of course. I mean, there's healthcare if you're lucky enough to be able to afford it, and so on and so on. But there's also, I think, a perception that many people have going in, well, maybe this is just a hobby for the artist or something to do on the side. You know, how much material and effort does it really take to do what they do? Oh, you know, again, as you said, Mark, often a lot of people sort of think that what they're doing is very beneficial. I mean, they're approaching it with a sense of goodwill, but in fact, it doesn't always play out that way. Dan, you're nodding a bit there.
Well, that's exactly one of the big issues behind charities that want artists to donate for fundraisers, that artists tend to really like being involved in good events, and they feel strongly about a lot of fundraisers because they strike at the fact that we're socially aware to begin with. But
they want to help out a good cause. You know, donate to the silent auction or the live auction.
But a big problem is that a lot of people aren't aware of, that we're trying to help people aware of, is that artists are not allowed to make a full tax deduction for what they donate. It's not like somebody donating a TV and that store being able to deduct the cost of that TV, which is a pretty hefty price. But artists can only deduct the cost of their materials.
Right, so not their time at all or
exactly.
talent.
Exactly. So, you know, how do you deduct the price of a little squeeze out of a tube of paint? It really comes up to very little.
That a lot of people aren't aware of. I mean, you know, you may look at, let's say, a painting is $1,000, and that seems reasonable, you know, given, you know, who maybe an artist is and their talent and what the work has sold for in the past, and you think, oh, they can, you know, deduct that full $1,000. But when you actually look at just the paint itself, if that's all you're talking about, the paint and the canvas, then you may be limited to just a couple $100 or less.
Right. You're also talking about a professional segment of society that gets paid less than other professionals. Even though most artists are college educated, bachelor's and master's degree, the average income for a visual fine artist across the country is between $15,000 and $20,000. So we're also talking about a professional group that makes less than everybody, but is constantly called upon to be a major donator.
I want to talk about how all this affects the artists in just a minute, but before we get to that, what advice do any of you have for people who are either collectors or people who are asking for a donation or a loan of something of that nature for their business or their organization or just purchasing? I mean, for people who are non-artists out there, what sort of ethical fair practice advice do you want them to take away from this?
Well, we of course want them to read our guidelines, and that's what we found is that there were a lot of artists being really frustrated by being asked to do these things and being told, oh, you have this great opportunity for exposure and all of these things, and getting really frustrated. And then the organizations, be they corporations or nonprofits, were getting frustrated too because they weren't getting the response they wanted. And at the Arts Council, we try to pull these two groups together. We try to create a line of communication between them. And what we found is that once these corporations and organizations understand the idea that Dan just talked about, that artists can't write this off in its entirety, and they do get asked constantly for these types of things, that a lot of them felt really bad about that, and they said, oh, well, what can we do? We don't want to do that. If it's bad for the artist, we certainly don't want to continue to do this.
Right, because, again, most of these people are approaching it with a sense of goodwill and wanting
absolutely,
to help out the artist.
Absolutely, yeah. Absolutely. All of them that we that come through my office have the best intentions. They really want to reach out to the arts community. They want the arts to be a part of their office or their group or their event or what have you. So it's all very goodwill involved, but it's just lack of communication, lack of education on the topic. So what we found coming out of this is that they're more than willing to look at these guidelines and say, you know what, we're going to change. We're going to, at our next event, instead of all the proceeds from the sale of this work, or the auction of this work, going to the fundraiser, we'll share that with the artist. 60% for the artist, 44% for the nonprofit, and we'll also make a minimum bid. We'll also make sure the artist knows who the purchaser is. We'll take these steps because we want it to be meaningful for the artist as well.
And it could also be nice to invite the artist to the invite sometimes.
That's a great idea, too. Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. Mark?
Well, what I advise artists is to select two or three organizations that they want to support.
Yeah.
And then look at different opportunities. But when you are approached by an organization that wants you to donate work, you can explain to them that you already have your two or three or four organizations that you've given work to, that you'll consider them for the future. But it gives everybody a very comfortable way out. And then as far as artists being offered to exhibit work, as Dan said, decorate the walls and things like that,
mm-hmm.
I advise artists to have a conversation with them about possibly opening the space up for some kind of reception that the host would pay for, helping with some marketing opportunities and things like that.
So that people can actually go see the work and meet the artist, and, I mean, sort of like an opening, if you would, even.
It has to be a two-way street.
Yeah.
There has to be an upside for the artist. And, again, you want to limit those types of things because, again, you're in business to sell things, to earn a living, and you can only take those donation opportunities and those free exhibition opportunities so far.
What sort of response have you been getting from artists about these guidelines?
It's been real handy to have something to refer to so that when somebody has a problem or a question, we can mm-hmm. say, go here, go to the iDotted.org website. We've gotten responses as far as way as Pennsylvania from an arts organization that was like, we were having problems with this too. Mm-hmm. Thank you for putting
sure.
this up. So as far as we can tell, we're the only ones in the country that have established suggested guidelines.
That's great. I mean, that's surprising and slightly disappointing, but congratulations to you
for
having that.
It's also a very valuable tool.
Yeah.
In the gallery, I would be approached all the time by people looking for this information,
mm-hmm.
and I could either try and take 20 or 30 minutes out of my day, or I can give them a basic introduction and then say, go to the iDotta website, click on the Ethics and Fair Practices icon,
mm-hmm.
and you can pull up all the information you're looking for.
What is it you want the artists to really get out of this? I mean, especially if artists are listening right now and you know, are going on the website, Mark, and checking out the Ethics and Fair Practices. I mean, what's the one thing you would sort of direct them to on this to help them gauge their own sense of worth and value?
Well, I think it's about being treated as a professional and having guidelines and knowing that there's a support system there for you. I think this speaks directly to what iDotta is all about, trying to help artists, trying to set professional standards, having artists treated fairly within the community. And I think if nothing else, they have a sense that they're just not isolated by themselves in the studio, but there are hundreds of other artists and organizations out there that have the same questions they do.
Dan, what else would you like to add?
That the education is going to be ongoing, that these issues are nothing new, and that every year there's going to be college graduates and emerging artists who a lot of times work somewhat in isolation, and once you get started as a business of being an artist, there's a dearth of information out there that we're trying to fill. So this is an ongoing process with us, not only in being able to talk to you today, but also in the future, you know, with workshops with the Arts Council mm-hmm. and with what we can do with iDotta and continually saying, here's the information, be educated. Education is power. And be a good businessman and be the professional that you think you should be.
Is there certainly some concern with maybe artists who aren't aware of these guidelines and are sort of going out there and essentially setting a poor standard because they're just not really thinking about it and it sort of undercuts everybody else? I mean, that's got to be a concern to some extent.
Yeah, we're all a tribe, and we need to take care of each other. So that's what we're here together for now as far as all the other artists. It's not just us individually.
Mm-hmm.
We want everybody to do better so that if somebody's confronted with a commission issue, to know that they can have this paperwork behind them, and these are some of the topics that they need to be concerned about when accepting a commission.
And I think the other thing is, if we want a world-class cultural community, the artists that are here are going to have to earn a good living. And if they're not, if the opportunities don't exist here for them, they'll move on. And that's counter to everything that's been going on in this city for the past 10 years. So we try and spread the word through IDOTA. We spread it through the Arts Council. We spread it word of mouth. The thing is to create the perception, or the reality, not the perception, but the reality that we are a professional arts community.
Mm-hmm. And Shannon, I'll let you have the last word on this roundtable today.
All right. Thanks, Travis. I think for me, working with the Arts Council and working with many more artists than even our members of IDOTA that throughout central Indiana, I think the thing that I really want to encourage all of them to focus on is, like Dan said, educating themselves. They're not going to learn a lot of these things in art school. You don't come out of school prepared for these types of things that happen. So you need to organize, join a group like IDOTA, become a member, if you will, of an organization like the Arts Council to be informed by the things that we're working on and the things that IDOTA is working on. And just, you are a business person. You need to make sure that if you want people to treat you like a business person, you need to act like one. And these types of guidelines will help you do that. That's
excellent.
Right.
Well, Shannon, Dan, Mark, thank you so much for coming into Art of the Matter today, and congratulations for putting this piece together. I know it will provide a lot of assistance to both professional artists and those who love art.
Thank you.
We appreciate you having us.
Travis DiNicola with three members of the IDOTA Ethics and Fair Practices Committee, Dan Cooper, Mark Rushman, and Shannon Linker. For more information, visit the Indianapolis Downtown Artists and Dealers Association website at idada.org. That's IDADA.org.
Sharon.
Yes, Travis.
The weather outside is fantastic.
It really is. I think everybody should go out and see and do some art things this week.
Sounds like a plan, so we'll be back next week with more on
What Will We Do?
You're listening to The Art of the Matter, a weekly show about the arts in Indianapolis and Central Indiana. Your hosts are Sharon Gamble and Travis DiNicola. If your arts organization has an event or activity of which you think we should be aware, please contact us at least 3 weeks in advance. You can write us at The Art of the Matter, care of WFYI, 1630 North Meridian Street, Indianapolis, Indiana, 46202. Or you can email us at artofthematter@wfyi.org. You can also hear The Art of the Matter on wfyi.org.
If your commute takes you through the Old North Side, you've no doubt noticed the transformation going on at the Central United Methodist Church, the former Old Centrum, at 12th and Central. The magical makeover, financed through a lead gift by Bill and Gail Cook, will result in this Romanesque Revival building becoming the new headquarters of Indiana Landmarks. Landmarks President Marsh Davis and Director of Education Suzanne Stannis slipped away from the construction zone to fill Sharon in on the renovation and the wondrous opening weekend coming up April 16th and 17th.
This is a grand opening that's been a long time in the making. Marsh, remind me of how you first came to look at the former Old Centrum and say, that could be our place.
It has been a long time in the making, but probably not as long as we would like, because it's coming on us very fast. I am a little fuzzy on my memory, but it seems like it was about three years ago or so when we realized that our very nice headquarters on the canal on West Michigan Street was not suited to any gatherings over about 30 or so people. And I was thinking, wouldn't it be wonderful if we had a venue where we could bring people to us and they could experience coming to our office, coming to an event or performance in a really wonderful historic building. And that's really how this started. About the same time, and that, by the way, was not necessarily with this particular building in mind, but about the same time, the Old Centrum Foundation that operated the building prior to us taking ownership last year, the Old Centrum Foundation was basically shutting down the operations and mothballing the building. And they called me over, the board of the Old Centrum Foundation called me to a meeting, and they said, well, we want you to know that we have now another white elephant historic building to worry about in Indianapolis. And so that's when we really started thinking about, well, maybe this could work with our program that we envision.
How did the Cooks get involved?
Well, Bill and Gail Cook from Bloomington have been preservationists for many years, and we have a long relationship with them. going back well before the big project they did at French Lick and West Baden. That's what they're most known for as far as their preservation work. But this is not a new venture for them, but they've not done a project in Indianapolis. And we invited them to come up and look at the building, knowing that it had an inspiring domed structure, which is something that they are interested in. And but they also understood the potential for a new center for Indiana Landmarks. They thought it made sense for our mission. They thought we could operate this in a way that would be not only historically inclined, but also entrepreneurial, and that we could make this building work as an income generator.
And I want to get back to that in the public spaces in a moment. But, Suzanne, this strikes me as a building that probably is one of the better documented buildings in Landmarks repertoire. Is that true? I mean, I know it's been added on to over the years. Remind us how it started out life.
We have quite a bit of information related to the building because it has been a church, and of course those are well documented. And most of the records concerning the building are housed at DePaul University in the archives of the Methodist Church. So we were able to work with a researcher who was able to go there, pull out a lot of photographs, pull out a lot of records, and put together a nice story of how the building came together. So it was built in three sections. The first section is the former sanctuary, and that was built in 1892. And then the wood-paneled auditorium was built in 1900. And then the classroom section was built in 1922. And that is where the offices of Indiana Landmarks will be.
I have the good fortune to drive down Central Avenue every morning on the way to work, so it's been kind of fun to see, you know, what big trucks will be there today and what kind of materials will be dropped off today. On the day we're having this conversation, many pallets of bricks were being dropped off because there's going to be a courtyard, and what will the function of that be?
The courtyard and also a parking area. It's more like a plaza, really. It's will be a very nicely designed parking space with a courtyard that will be used for as people visit the building, they'll walk through the courtyard. We'll have heavy landscaping. It will also be a place that if we have weddings that people can gather. There could be photo shoots in that area, in good weather, which we may experience one of these months. we think that this can be a place for spillover into the out of doors. But the parking lot itself is made of pavers that are permeable pavers, so that it's a green approach to constructing a parking area. But it's going to be rather lovely, and I think that we'll be tempted to use it for more than just parking cars. I see its use for maybe some outdoor events for the neighborhood or for the broader community. It's going to be quite nice.
You know, the public will get a chance to see all of these spaces in a series of events. I know we're mostly thinking about the WOW, the Wondrous Opening Weekend, today, but there's another, there's the storytelling event, there's an organ premiere event, and much, much more. But let's start with the big WOW. And it's going to show off on its weekend. It's going to show off most of the public spaces that would be available for rental or where you might house your own activities, right?
That's correct. Mm-hmm.
So people will come in through this lovely new bricked courtyard, and I'm hoping some of that good weather you're wishing for happens on the opening weekend. The first event is the Landmarks premiere event, and that's Saturday afternoon.
Yes, that event has been rather popular, so we're a little oversubscribed right now. So, unfortunately, for those who would like to attend it, we're full. But that's an exciting event. We have John Mellencamp as our opening act. Charles Webb will be dedicating the restored organ, which is a whole restoration story unto itself.
Because the organ's not originally from... Well, the organ is from Landmarks, but it was built by a builder who went away, right?
Well, it was built for that church in 1892 by an organ builder who had a shop on Massachusetts Avenue. And we've taken it out, and it's been restored entirely and better than ever now by Goulding and Wood, a wonderful company, also on Mass Avenue. within blocks of where the organ actually began its life. So it's come full circle, and they are, right as we speak, they are installing the organ. And it's been not only sonically restored, but the cabinetry, the console, it's truly a work of art. Even if you don't turn the thing on, just looking at it is going to be a wonder.
And the weekend includes on Sunday from 11 to 2 an open house. It's open to everybody, absolutely free of charge. There'll be docents with tours and a chance to learn a little bit about the history of the building.
Yes, it'll be a chance for people to come in for free and see the space, and we will have docents in each of the rooms talking about the history of it, how it was restored, and we'll have refreshments available, and hopefully some musical groups, and the organ will be played also.
And then one more chance, especially, and I think it's not a surprise that the focus is on music, because the acoustics of the former sanctuary, which is now called Cook Grand Hall, is that correct?
Well, the Grand Hall is the former sanctuary, and the
right.
Cook Theater is
the
former
Theater.
Auditorium.
And they both have, everybody focuses on the acoustic of the sanctuary, but the theater has great acoustics as well. So
yes, very, very, a little drier sound, which some people prefer.
Mm-hmm.
But we have a good range of acoustics in there.
And from 4:30 to 8, the Classical Bash on Sunday showcases music, and that'll be in the former sanctuary.
Yeah, that's going to be an exciting event, and their tickets are still available for that. And you get quite a package with that. We have our artist-in-residence, our first artist-in-residence, is called the Landmark Trio, and this is comprised of Marianne Tobias on piano, Jeff Lapin on cello, and Zach DePew, violin. Zach, of course, is the concertmaster of the Indianapolis Symphony Orchestra. And they participated early on with us in an acoustical check when the building was still in very rough condition. We didn't have the support lined up to save the building, but they've been with us really from just about the beginning in advocating for the restoration of this building. So it's great to have them with us, and they're supremely talented musicians.
And they're being joined by a singer some people might have heard of.
Mm-hmm. Yes, we're very fortunate to have Sylvia McNair as to cap off the evening. There'll be some other entertainers as well on Sunday evening, but Sylvia McNair will be our topping off the evening performance. And then lots and lots of food and drink. We have caterers that will be working with us in the building, and they are all going to be there with their wares on display for us to partake.
Boy, that's a perfect event for maybe somebody who's planning a wedding and wants to sample all the caterers. They can come in that night and
yes.
See which ones they like.
And this will be a fabulous venue for weddings. It is almost ideally, it is ideally suited for weddings, not just the wedding, the ceremony, but also the reception. I don't think you'll find a better venue.
What is the seating capacity of the two main venues we're talking about?
We're using roughly 450 seats for the Grand Hall, and which has fixed seating, by the way. We have the historic pews that have been restored and reinstalled. And then in the Cook Theater, the seating is not fixed, so we can adjust things. For instance, we're having our first big dinner will be for, I believe, 300 people. That's seated around a table. So there's a great deal of flexibility in the theater.
Wow. What's been the biggest surprise to the both of you as you've gone through on this journey of looking at what this building could be and figuring out how to renovate it? I know I've heard somebody from your staff refer to something like 23 different levels in the building complex. Did I imagine that? 23?
Well, that's an unpleasant surprise. Yeah, that's a challenge.
How did that happen? I mean, well, gosh.
This building was built long before ADA, before there was even a sensitivity to that to making things comfortable for people, and it was also built in different stages. As Suzanne said, there were three different eras of construction. We've been able, thanks to the great problem-solving efforts of the architects, to basically come up with a series of elevators with multiple stops, and you can get anywhere in the building by way of an elevator or a series of stairways and ramps. So it will accommodate people, but it's not been easy. It's a very complicated building.
Yeah. kudos to you for your persistence and vision. Have people been coming out of the woodwork who remember going to that church and contacting you, Suzanne?
There have been, and that's also a part of the Storyteller event that we're hosting on April 29th. Through the generosity of Frank and Katrina Basile, we've been able to commission a storyteller who could interview people that used to go to the church or people from the neighborhood. And she has compiled some wonderful stories that she's putting together for this event.
Favorite part of the building? Or campus or complex? I'm not quite sure how to talk about it.
But I think, for me, it's the Cook Theater. The walking in there and seeing the warmth of the woodwork, and knowing that, unlike so many historic buildings, that woodwork was never painted. It just really had to be cleaned and shined, and it really brings back the time period, and I really, you know, kind of feel like I'm back in the early 19th century when I'm in that room particularly.
Do you have a favorite part, Marsh?
Well, I have to agree, and I think most people that see that building, they're wowed by the former sanctuary, but when they walk into that wooden room, the auditorium or the Cook Theater now, it's unique. I mean, I use that word sparingly. It is a unique space in our city and probably our state, and the fact that it survived relatively unscathed, unlike most of the rest of the building, this was in very very good condition. But I would also venture that when the organ is reinstalled with the cabinetry and all its splendor and gold leaf, that's probably going to take the cake for me, I think.
Sharon Gamble with Marsh Davis, President, and Suzanne Stannis, Director of Education, both of Indiana Landmarks. The statewide not-for-profit is America's largest private statewide historic preservation organization, and it's celebrating the grand opening of the Indiana Landmarks Center with a wondrous opening weekend, April 16th and 17th. Also coming up as part of the grand opening month, a special story commissioned to tell the history of the building and a dedication concert of the pipe organ. Find out more at indianalandmarks.org. Thanks for joining us today. The music for today's show is courtesy of the Vaselli Wallrap Jazz Orchestra from their Heart and Soul album, available through Owl Studios at owlstudios.com.
Please listen to The Art of the Matter again next Friday at 8 and Saturday at 4 when I'll preview the Stutz Open House.
I'll find out what's going on at the Vonnegut Library.
And I'll hear what's new for the Indianapolis Symphonic Choir. Plus, we'll have our Arts Calendar Week Hall.
What'll we do? So please listen next Friday at 8 and Saturday at 4 for The Art of the Matter here on WFYI for your information.
You've been listening to The Art of the Matter, made possible by the ongoing support of listeners like you and from the Palladium at the Center for the Performing Arts, presenting its inaugural season through June. The Art of the Matter. Your hosts are Sharon Gamble and Travis DiNicola. Today's Art of the Matter was produced and edited by Travis DiNicola. The Art of the Matter on 90.1 FM, Indianapolis.